Okay, maybe we'll cut that then. moving on.
Standard issue for all women.
Hello and welcome to episode 297 of the Standard Issue Podzine. I'm Mickey Noonan, and yesterday I queued for cheesecake, fed a swan an apple and stroked a parakeet. And none of those are euphemisms.
It was your birthday.
It was my birthday, and what a day. Look at how much I packed in.
Exactly. I mean, you queued for cheesecake. Do you think you're in New York now or something?
Yeah, yeah. I'm walking here. Almost as good as my French accent there. You know, accents
here.
Aren't my thing. But I actually, like, hand-fed a swan. How brave am I? They'll have your arm off.
I was going to say they can break your arm, Mick, allegedly.
Allegedly.
That's what people say, isn't it?
But they really like apple. I hang out with some really friendly geese at the weekend. That's not even my fact.
I don't believe you.
They were very shouty. They did shout a lot, but they were pretty friendly. Anyway, I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and I'm definitely getting old, and I know this because I got on a bus, and I thought, oh, he's handsome. How about the bus driver? Which I think now means that the start of my inevitable decline into old lady has begun. I'll be able to go back and pinpoint that was the moment I turned into an old lady.
Did you
get off at the next stop? Hey.
Also, no.
I don't believe you.
Wanking on public transport. Very much not female behaviour.
No, off the bus, not on the bus.
We were watching CBeebies the other day and it was Red Nose Day and they were doing this Blue Peter. I mean, I really resent that because I don't expect to find Blue Peter on CBeebies and it's just shit, isn't it, Blue Peter? But anyway.
What?
Anyway.
Blue Peter's dog shit, man. It's like school after school's finished. It's just like, it's rubbish.
Why are you
anyway.
Blue Peter?
I have a Blue Peter badge.
Absolutely not.
Of course you do.
Well, I'm a bit jealous of that, but I hated Blue Peter. Anyway, so Blue Peter was on and the presenters, I said to my mum, I was like, I mean, they are really young, aren't they? And she said, no, you're just getting old. So, thanks, Kev.
I'm glad that the concept of time has finally started to make sense to you both.
I'm Jen Offord, and I'm really nervous about Cowboy Carter.
I don't understand what that means.
It's Beyoncé's forthcoming country and western-inspired album.
Oh, man, I'm excited.
Texas Hold'em is amazing.
That's all right, but 16 Carriages is whack. I don't like it at all. I'm really nervous.
Is whack a bad thing? I always thought whack meant something was quite good.
No, whack is bad.
Okay.
Is she doing this just on her own or is she bringing in some country and western people?
There is a rumour that she's going to do a cover of Jolene, which I'll be okay with. I'll be fine with that.
I'm sure she'll be relieved to hear that, Jen.
Yeah,
I know. You know, I'm pleased that she's powerful enough that she can do whatever the fuck she likes at this stage in her career and just be like, you've come in for this? I don't care. I'm going to give you that. But at the same time, it wouldn't be my genre of choice. Coming up, I chat to writer Anushka Warden about her debut novel, I'm Fucking Amazing, as well as sweary titles and female pleasure.
The very brilliant indeed Holly McNish talks to me about vulvas, joy, G-strings, hate and lobster. That last one is the title of her wonderful new book. And she does one of her poems. Lovely stuff.
Hooray!
That is lovely. In Journey Off the Blocks, we're talking about inappropriate relationships, a theme that we're carrying over into Rated or Dated as we discuss 1984's Terms of Endearment.
But first, kings, emperors and Queen Laura Bates, it's time for the Bush Telegraph. But just before that, before I say Houston, we need to talk about Patreon.
We do.
And I know it's hard because no one likes talking about money. I don't even like thinking about talking about money. Vomits, yeah.
But, you know, here we are.
Let's just rip the plaster and do it. We have a Patreon, which you can find at patreon.com/standardissue, where for as little as £1 a month, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free.
A pound?
A pound.
That seems like a very good deal.
It is.
Do you get anything else for your money?
Well, funny you should ask that, as if that isn't enough. No. But soon, and I do mean soon, we are introducing some more excellent reasons to join.
Ooh, like a competition or something.
Exactly, Mickey. Like a competition and bonus content and a chance to be on the podcast yourself.
Whoa! Woe indeed, Mixta Noonan.
And when are we going to find out more? When are we going to find out? When are we going to find out? When are we going to find out?
Soon. Soon. Very soon.
Okay. Shall I say the web address again? I shall. patreon.com/standardissue.
Thank you, Mick. Cue Sting.
Bush Telegraph.
Welcome to the Bush Telegraph, where we're constantly refreshing the news in the hope of a general election. Rishi, if you're listening, imagine that, Hannah. Imagine that. Rishi Sunak, big fan of the show. Name the date. Rip off that plaster. Fuck the fuck off.
Yeah. Now, I'm no royal expert.
What?
But what if Prince William is having an affair, / was replaced by a body double in the mid-90s, / murdered the guy who lights the fires at Buckingham Palace, / has stashed Kate wherever it is they put Shelley Miscavige? That would mean that we'd get good King Harry, right? Desperate eyes, right? Okay, if you think that sounds mad, you've obviously not been on social media recently, which is awash with theories as to why Kate Middleton hasn't been seen in public since the palace announced she'd be recovering from an operation until Easter. Which, to be totally honest, seemed reasonable to me if she'd had an operation.
Yeah, totally.
I didn't want to know any more, partly because I don't care, and partly because, as several people I do care about will tell you, my response to operations is usually, I love you, have some flowers, let's talk about anything but your bum/eye/septic extremity.
Septic Extremity is a great name for a band. I think it's available.
Here's an example of something that was retweeted into my timeline, so to be clear, someone really thought I should know this. My current working theory is that Charles is dying, which means that William would be king, and William would not want Kate to be his queen because commoner, separated, rocky marriage. So he asked for a divorce and planned to marry Rose Hanbury, but then it was discovered that Rose's sons are really William's. And since those boys, brackets twins, are older than George, that would change the entire royal line of succession. That's by someone called Heidi Ann Moore, who later, I have to say, did try to do the whole, it does make sense what I've said, and then later it was just a joke. Anyway, I love the way she starts that with, in a sincere attempt to convey that she's actually thought about this using her actual brain cells, rather than basing it on, I don't know, a speed watch of the crown, a shit ton of cheese and a slightly too long nap.
That sounds lovely.
For what it's worth, fat fans, bastards don't get to take the throne. And by that, I mean bastard in the old sense of the word. Bastards in the other sense of the word very much do. I'd tell her to get a Ouija board out and ask for the Duke of Monmouth, but I'd bet my life savings that she's no idea who he is. If you do it though, Heidi, I'd love to know if it was the head or the rest of him that turned up.
Your entire life savings. Heidi, come on, there's like 25 quid in this for you.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, it's like when you want 20p. Here's another classic of the genre. Flags at half-mast in some government buildings, BBC going all black again, going also on standby for an imminent big royal announcement. Either King Charles is dead, abdicating, or Kate died. Which was swiftly followed by this. Just so you know, the sources are literally Twitter, so take this with a grain of salt. I've got a couple more if you've got time. Here's one. Because, you know, Barack Obama was over here the other day. Sunak. Barack Obama is an expert in constitutional law. I wonder if he's in the UK to help the British government solve a constitutional crisis. I mean, we're on constitution, but okay. If an heir to the British throne has to abdicate or be charged with a crime, is that a constitutional crisis? Now, you might be thinking, who's going to be charged with a crime? Here's another one, Mickey. A rumour alleges Charles will appoint a regent until the next heir comes of age because William supposedly beat Kate to death, thus making him unsuitable to be king. Wildest thing about this rumour is the idea that killing his wife has never, ever disqualified a king of England. No, the wildest thing about that rumour, love, is that you fucking tweeted it. But anyway...
Not even the top 1% of weird shit on Twitter, though, is it?
God bless Twitter/X/ the crappiest place on earth for bringing all that into my life. Not just the hoi polloi hurling themselves into the argument like Begbie on a particularly enthusiastic bender. In a piece in the New York Times titled Kate Middleton's Story is About So Much More Than Kate Middleton, Zeynep Tufekci essentially argues that all of this attention on Kate's illness is okay, because everyone is mean to Meghan Markle.
Wow.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. The only equality worth seeking is one where everybody gets treated equally well.
I might have to make you say it again, Hannah, because people just don't get it.
Now, as I said at the top, in jest, although I also mean it, I'm no expert. Events may supersede me. Perhaps any or all of this is true.
All of it, yeah.
Perhaps William is having an affair, a rumour I actually first heard from an actual journalist in 2018 as a possible explanation as to why Billy and Belly fell out. 400 interviews, a Netflix documentary and a book later, we've still not heard anything concrete about it, which doesn't prove that it's true or that it's not true. My position on the royals remains unchanged since the late 1970s. I don't like any of those pricks. But I've enough faith in humanity to believe an uncle wouldn't do that to his nieces and nephews. I mean, what have we learned about how we treat princesses of Wales? Apparently nothing. More news when it happens. More speculation ad infinitum.
Oh, just people can't get enough. I was kind of sucked in for a millisecond yesterday and messaged Hannah and Jen with my, do you think the king is dead? And then I was like, sorry, guys, what am I doing? I'm so sorry. I had not researched this. Please, I retract that immediately. It's just Twitter nonsense.
I'm going to say in your defence, Mickey, you weren't actually in the country when the Queen died.
That is true.
In the sense of how the media cycle worked. So we know that now.
Yeah.
Now we've seen what happens is that you get this tweet saying, oh, something's happening. And right. An announcement coming soon. It came from the BBC. Then it was, and we knew she died. You could just feel it. Whereas nothing about those tweets I saw yesterday came with the wording or the sort of sense that something had happened.
Okay. A lack of gravitas, basically.
Yeah. None of them came from like a weird account in Turkey, is all I'm saying.
This shit show is just one family. As much as I'm in almost constant despair at how appallingly humans are capable of treating each other, I will never not be pleasantly surprised by the tremendous courage that shows up time and time again. In 2020, Louise Powell, then 33, generated profound concern when news emerged that she'd given birth to a stillborn baby, Brooke, in a prison toilet at HMP Style. Louise said she believed her baby girl could have survived had she had more timely and appropriate medical intervention. That's horrific, right? And not a one-off. Louise's loss followed the death of baby Aisha Cleary, who was delivered by her mother, Rihanna Cleary, alone in her prison cell at HMB Bronzefield in September 2019. Now, women represent less than 5% of the prison population and, as talked about previously on this podcast, are often sentenced to custody for non-violent, low-level offences. Not paying the TV licence, for example. Campaign organisations such as Level Up and Birth Companions have for a long time been trying to stop or at least reduce the passing of custodial sentences on pregnant women and new mothers, given the risk the prison system clearly poses to pregnant women, new mothers and their babies. Three cheers for all their hard work then, as the Sentencing Council is announcing significant new guidance that judges and magistrates in England and Wales must consider before passing sentences on pregnant women and new mothers. A new mitigating factor in sentencing has been introduced, pregnancy, childbirth and postnatal care, replacing current guidance relating to this group of women who currently come under the much broader heading of, quote, sole or primary carer. This change should result in fewer pregnant women and mothers being sent to prison. And here's that tremendous courage I mentioned, as Louise Powell has applauded the decision, saying, I am very pleased that the system is being changed so that no other mother has to lose their baby in prison. Brooke is always in my heart, and I hope that her legacy is a long-standing change to the imprisonment of pregnant women. No woman should have to give birth behind bars.
Quite.
I know.
Do you want a bit of good news, Mickey?
I think we need a bit of good news, Hannah. Is it about the royal family?
No. As you know, our mate Laura Bates wrote a fantasy YA novel called Sisters of Sword and Shadow. That title absolutely screams franchise, right? And you'd
she
be right
is
to think
very
that.
Clever. Yeah.
There's a second book, Sisters of Fire and Fury, in the pipeline. It is, quote, an immersive, alternative Arthurian legend exploring what might happen if the Fellowship of the Round Table had an all-female counterpart. Ugh, look at this woman taking one of our most beloved made-up things and replacing the made-up men with made-up women. The world's gone mad.
What's next? Equal pay? Shop.
This week it was announced that Two Brothers, the production company behind Fleabag, had bought the rights to adapt it into a TV series.
Hooray!
Do you want to hear what Laura said?
Yes, please.
She said, "I knew from the very first meeting with Two Brothers that they were the perfect team for this project. I loved their vision, enthusiasm and fierce sense of feminist joy. Working with them on this project is a dream come true."
Lovely stuff. Is it weird? Is it too petty for me to be a tiny bit miffed that the production company is called Two Brothers?
Two Brothers, yeah. I did think
that. Have to get involved with everything, Hannah. More news next week.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week.
It's that time of the week where I ask a man how often they think of the Roman Empire. Hannah, do you have a man handy?
I do not.
Me neither. All right. Hannah, how often do you think of the Roman Empire?
Maybe once a week.
That's quite often. What thoughts come into your mind when you're thinking about it?
What I will say, Mickey, is the last time somebody asked me this question, which was my friend Karen, because she'd read, presumably what you'd read, I explained to her about how Julius Caesar defeated Vercingetorix, and a look fell across her face that could only be described as just immediately regretting that she'd asked me that question.
What she needs to do is go on a brilliant trip to Rome with you and like learn more about the city than any tour guide could have told me, and see Bruce Springsteen. Bloody wound. Okay, you'd mentioned Caesar there. Julius specifically, there are a few of them. Who is your favourite Roman emperor?
He wasn't a Roman emperor, was he? It depends what you mean by favourite, Mickey, because, I mean, who would I want to live under? Probably Vespasian, because it was quite simple and he wasn't too warlike and he was okay with money and he built lots of nice things. But if you're talking about who would you want to study, I mean, one of the truly mad bastards, clearly, like Caligula or Nero.
Yeah, yeah. I thought at first you were going to say who would I want to live with, and now I want to know which one you want to live with.
Absolutely not a one of them. They did quite often beat their wives to death.
Any ideas why I'm asking you all of this, Hannah?
Shits and giggles. I mean, who's your favourite Roman emperor, Mickey?
I think I'd have to go for Mad Bastard Caligula, just because it's just like, it's just shock and awe. It's like ancient Twitter in one man.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. Anyway,
if
all of this,
Twitter was fucking his sisters.
You know, I'm not ruling that out, to be honest. All of this is currently a big deal on TikTok. Obviously, I haven't seen this for myself because I don't understand TikTok and I'm full. No, thank you. Couldn't fit it in. But according to Know Your Meme or Know Your Meme, this current TikTok trend originated on Instagram when Swedish influencer Saskia Kort went viral in 2022 for telling her followers to ask their male partners the big question. How often do you think about the Roman Empire? Apparently, to the amusement of many women, the legacy of Rome still burns bright in the minds of men and Hannahs across the world. But any ideas why this might be sexism of this week, Hannah?
Is it because we're assuming that women aren't interested in the Roman Empire?
Yeah, well, some people are assuming that women aren't interested in the Roman Empire, but specifically, the British Museum decided to get involved in the memeing, but holy moly, did it read the room full of ancient things wrong when it suggested women walk around its new exhibition, Legion, Life in the Roman Army, quote, looking confused in order to attract men.
Oh, boom. Too fuck off.
Hold that thought, Hannah, and then maybe amplify it in a second, because for full effect, I'm going to read out the now deleted, of course, social media post, which said, quote, girlies, if you're single and looking for a man, this is your sign to go to the British Museum's new exhibition, Life in the Roman Army, and walk around looking confused. You're welcome, kiss. Or maybe that's an X and it means 10. There's no way of knowing. I think I'm actually most bothered by the term girlies, but you know, the implication history is owned by men is also annoying, very annoying. The further implication that women should hide their smarts in order to catch a man is also annoying, very annoying. Not out of 10, British Museum. No TikTok for you. Please try harder.
Oh, dear God. Would you like to know how Julius Caesar defeated Vercingetorix?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Right. The good news is, imagine a donut.
All right. Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question, and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time, and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much, that does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard. Hello, I'm joined on the Zoom by award-winning poet, best-selling author, and daughter of the woman who has finally given me a watertight reason to hate G-strings, Holly McNish. Holly, hello.
That's the best introduction I've had. I'll have to get my mum to definitely listen to this.
Can you share with the listeners what your mum has told you about thongs? Because I've always been suspicious of them.
Yeah, so my mum is a nurse. She told me a lot about everything, I think. I was talking about that quite a lot in the book, all the things she told me about the body. But one thing that she told me is don't wear thongs because I can't really remember how she put it from a medical profession, but it could move bacteria into the vaginal area from the anus, was what she said, probably. But I took it as it can move shit
from your ass
to your vag. That's how I would put it.
It's such a visceral image, isn't it? Of like little poo particles clinging on to like the little, like a zip wire.
Yeah, ooh. Just the string that going back and forth. But she told me that when I was 14, when it was getting quite popular horrendously for like 13, 14 year olds to be sort of sold thongs. So I don't know if it's true, but I think it is.
I'm going with it's true. She's a medical professional.
Yeah, I know, but I didn't know if she told me that just to stop me from wanting to wear thongs, but it worked all my life. I think it is true. Like, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and they're so uncomfortable.
I'm sure I must have been like 30 when I realised that the point of all underwear wasn't for someone else to see it. Like, that there is like there is underwear that you might specifically buy for certain occasions, but I remember I really don't find lace underwear comfy at all, and that's all I had seen ever on and I remember my friend being like, well, that's fine, but that's not like the point of underwear is obviously it's very practical reasons that you have underwear. I was like, oh yeah, the point of it is not to either, you know, not be seen under trousers or look right with a certain outfit, or it's just to catch things, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to be honest with you, and it'll come as no surprise to listeners, and it's a joy to be with someone where the phrase too much information isn't really a thing. But the knickers I'm wearing today literally are kind of shorts, and I can pull them up over my boobs. They're amazing.
Can you?
Yeah.
And I've stopped calling those sorts of knickers like granny pants or comfy pants. I find that really funny. Like, any pants that are like actually comfortable while I was being brought up had like another adjective put in them.
Yeah.
Like, so people would sort of apologise for wearing them. And there was that thing, I don't know if you had it, but that thing where I had friends that would worry if they got run over on a certain day if they were wearing like literally their comfy pants, like we call it our comfy pants, is like as if that's not the point of underwear. It's nuts, isn't it, all the things that you've been told and have just like seeped into your seeped into your mind.
Yeah, let's call them everyday pants because that's what they are for me
everyday
now.
Yeah, we're just pants.
Just pants. So I learned the G-string fact from your brand new book of poetry and prose, Lobster. Can you tell us a little bit about Lobster?
Yes. So Lobster is the second half, basically, of my last book, but you don't have to have read the other book. It's just that they're quite similar. So it's called Lobster and Other Things I'm Learning to Love. And it is a collection of poems and prose stories and memories and stuff around the poems. And it's all about things that I have been, that I've realised I've been sort of made somehow to feel either embarrassed about or ashamed or just to find kind of disgusting. And it's questioning why I find certain things disgusting, which is why it's called Lobster, because I really find lobster so disgusting.
Oh.
But that, yeah, exactly. And they've never done anything to me. And they're just these creatures that are like keeping themselves to themselves. But I also find it really disgusting the few times I've seen people eating lobster and sort of choosing them and then like ripping their bodies apart and telling me it's like an aphrodisiac. So I was sort of thinking of that. And then I was thinking about all the other things that I find or have found disgusting, and I'm trying not to do things about the body, like bodily fluids. I think I've been told to be disgusted by like every single fluid that comes out of my body, like whether that has been sweat or menstrual blood or even breast milk or tears even. It just seems like we've been told to be disgusted by everything, and actually not the things that we should, I think, be disgusted by.
Totally. And that hateful voice in our head can be so loud. You have this brilliant idea, or something that you do now, of a swear jar, but instead of for swearing, you put money in every time you're mean to yourself when you look in the mirror or at a photograph. And my first thought was, I genuinely couldn't afford it.
Which, oh, that's so awful.
Isn't it? Given I'm about to turn 47 and I do this for a living, bigging up women for a living, it just really is quite sad, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's also really understandable because I think as well people beat themselves up for feeling like that. But it's no wonder, like anyone that doesn't feel like that, it's like a genius. Like I feel like I'm writing poems all the time to convince myself of it. It's not that I'm already thinking, yeah, I'm fine. Like I'm, you know, my body's great or whatever. But there's a lot of pressure to find yourself disgusting or to find certain things or certain people or, you know, whatever. There's so much money spent all the time. Like every day you're going to see something which somehow gets into your head the idea that you are not good enough in some way or another. So I actually think more normal to be disgusted by a lot of things, which it shouldn't be, but also that people shouldn't like blame themselves if they do feel that way, because there are a lot of outside forces as advertising and products and all sorts that they're really good at it, and that's sort of the whole point. It's a bit of a David and Goliath thing, I think.
Totally. And if it didn't work, they wouldn't still be throwing millions and billions of pounds at it, which is another point you make.
No, they're not stupid. Yeah.
So Lobster reads not so much as a manifesto against hate, but more sort of as a manifesto for joy. I really love the positivity. I really love that you're very candid, that you're still a work in progress. Like you say, you're not like, guys, I've got this, let me help you out. And like Slug before it, it's hugely life-affirming. I wondered what was the one thing you've had to work hardest at or might still be working really hard not to hate.
So I think, and I sort of don't like admitting it really, I think there's a section in the book on accents. And I think the thing that I probably have to work hardest at is not judging people if they speak with like received pronunciation. I think that is my main thing from everything in this book, because I think everything else, like with my body, I think I'm getting towards that, like, God, dude, like life is too short, like these people have taken too much of your time and money convincing you of this stuff, like you cannot spend any more time even thinking about this, like I've got so much stuff I want to do and people I want to see and hug and stuff. But still, when I speak to someone, and I'm sure someone else will probably have it with my accent, I've got quite a, you know, middle class southern English accent. Yeah, just when I hear someone speaking in a way that I guess I was brought up only hearing sort of royalty and politicians speak with received pronunciation, and then went to university and the only people that were really mean to me had this sort of accent. I think that was the bit that I was thinking, should I leave this in the book? Should I not? But I think that's probably mine. And when I meet somebody and they immediately speak in that accent that's like royalty, I have so many preconceived ideas of their like upbringing, their private school education, all this sort of stuff. And I've always got my mum in my head, who's always trying to sort of just stop me from being like that.
Because,
yeah, just people don't choose whether or not how they're brought up. And, you know, a dickhead is a dickhead.
Wherever they went to school. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's it. And there's this idea that, well, that's okay because most people that speak like that are probably really wealthy and therefore it's okay to sort of judge, but I don't think it is. All right. Yeah. That's my hardest.
I think I'm an inverted snob as well. So the wise words, more wise words from Mother McNish. Yeah. Sort of rang true to me.
The book's basically written by my mum, really. It's like through me.
So rude that she wouldn't come on. She sent you on instead.
Yeah, isn't it?
It is a manifesto for joy. It really is. Like, listeners, it's so lovely. I've been reading and beaming and kind of like nodding along. But as with anything that has a focus on girls and women and the female body, which is always something you talk about in your poetry and in your prose, it is also, of course, fury making. So, Holly, I don't want to pigeonhole you, but can we talk vulvas, or specifically the word vulva and your like tricky campaign to make it more accepted, even though you fight with yourself about it.
So I think that's one of the things as well, like that's from the section. There's a section on words, basically, and words that we hate to say. And me just question, like, I can understand certain words that are really derogatory, really abusive. But the word vulva is one that's not. And it amazes me how far we go not to say that word. And I've had amazing responses to, like, it wasn't my idea to start talking about it, but I've just read so much about child protection, so much about the sort of just knowing your own body and being confident to talk about your body, whether that's through abuse that you might be talking about, or whether it's to do with pleasure and talking about what you want, or whether it's just not feeling like there's this part of your body that's invisible. But yeah, it amazes me the amount, like, I've had some really great responses from people when I've sort of posted campaigns that other groups have done to get people to just use that word in schools and with their children and, you know, in nurseries and whatever. Like, one guy even said, it's like, why would you ever need to say this to a child? Actually, I'm quite worried. Actually, I think I need to phone the police. But just like,
fucking hell.
Just that. Just the idea that you would never need to talk about that to a child, where it's literally the part of your body that you, like, wee from. All things aside, it's all right to be able to name, you know, your body parts. It's ridiculous to just skip out this one part all the time. But it's a really, really well-used part of the body from birth. So the idea that it's a weird thing to talk about, but it's just because we don't have a kiddie word for it, so we have to use the adult word, and we don't do that with boys because they've got the word willy, even though other people say that you should also just use the word penis with boys, but they do have this word that everyone knows. Whereas with vulva, there's like thousands and thousands of different things, or so many people just don't talk about that part of the body. Yeah, it's so frustrating. It's just ridiculous. Like, when you think of all the stuff, it's ridiculous. And I keep meeting people that are like, that's really weird. I read that bit of your book and I find it hard to say that. And it's a bit like the sort of hating your body things. Like, that's not weird. That's like the normal response in this society. Yeah, it's actually weirder when people are totally fine with it.
Yeah.
And people beat themselves up about not being able to say it in exactly the same way. People are like, oh, why, I shouldn't be so mean to myself, as if it's an individual, your fault thing. But it's not. It's just a response to, like, this culture. It's like the word moist as well.
I love the word moist because it makes people so uncomfortable. It's mad.
So uncomfortable. So uncomfortable. It's like, oh, why? There's so many studies that have been done about it. And people, even yesterday, I had a gig in Ely and I had loads of people say, that's so weird about moist, because I really hate that word. And it's like, no, that's not weird that you hate that word. Like, everyone hates that word, about moist, and all the percentage of people that don't. But yeah, it's all just so linked, isn't it?
It is. And the argument that by teaching kids the proper medical terms for their body parts, we're somehow sexualizing them, when it's the opposite. We're taking away anything apart from it just being a term, like an arm or an ear or a nose. That's all on the grown-ups, not on the kids.
That's all on the grown-ups. And I really think that I'm sort of slightly suspicious and worried after all the reading I've done of anyone that specifically wants to take their kid out of a class that's going to teach them the correct word for their private part. I just think, yeah. Also, I don't know why we ostracize the parents too much in education. Like, we don't really ask for their advice on other aspects of the curriculum. But yeah, I get sent a letter as a mum from primary school saying, do you think it's okay to teach the word vulva? Like, I literally got that letter. I was like, why are you asking parents? You know there's going to be some people that are not okay with it. Just like there are some people not okay with teaching various other things that you deem important for kids to know. So just don't ask our advice. I'd say sometimes. So
let's ask a really nice positive question, because it's such a joyous positive book. What is filling your heart with love and joy at the moment, Holly?
At the moment, I am looking out on Arthur's Seat in Edinburgh. So I think the view of this massive piece of rock covered in like flowers that are newly arriving for spring is filling my heart with joy, and the sky is very blue. And in general, I think
just friends
and love and hugs and touch. I think it's quite basic, really, the things that most people find happiness in. And there's like loads of other shit that we seem to be inventing and trying to push, but feels like most of the things that we like could be pretty cheap if we allowed people access to them.
I feel like you just condensed your 460-page book into like a few words, which is friends and love and hugs and touch.
Yeah.
They are the things that come up over and over again.
Yeah, and it could be. I think life could be summed up like that. And yeah, totally. Just stop being mean. Just stop being mean. Like, that was the rule. That'd be great. Yeah, I think the book could be summed up in about 10 seconds. And it's like, stop being a dickhead and be nice to each other.
I used to work at The Stand in Edinburgh, and they had a big sign in the back room that just said, don't be a dick. I mean, yeah, clearly a lot of the comedians doing their stuff there hadn't read that sign, but I do think it's a good mantra for life.
Yeah, I think the book's really soppy as well. And actually sometimes I get embarrassed by my soppiness, but when you're sort of sitting on your own writing, it's fine, because you forget other people might read these things. But that's something I think I've embraced in the last like 10 years. And maybe because people I love have died, and I just think everything's too short not to just be nice, but also tell people how much you love them if you do. So I think I'm a really soppy person now. So in between the kind of moaning and complaining, which I think we have to do because there's a lot of crap to complain about, I think it is mainly loving and soppy and full of joy.
So Holly, you are currently on tour. Where can people find out where and when they can catch you doing your thing?
So they can find out from my lovely, constantly updated by myself website, which is hollymcnish.com, or from Instagram. If you just put in Holly McNish, it will come up, or Facebook, or
TikTok.
I won't be finding you there, but that's more about me than you. You are very kindly going to do a bit of your thing for us now.
Yeah. I don't know if this is the best poem to have chosen, but I've got a big, beautiful card that I have that says "You're my lobster" on it, saved in this page. So this is one of the very moany poems and not one of the joyous poems, which maybe it's just not gone with. But it's called "Self-Made". So this is one of my like most hated phrases that people, I think, often like overconfidently use about how they've achieved everything by themselves. And I wrote this after hearing a very wealthy and born into wealth politician declare himself self-made. So I wrote this poem to like get that off my chest so I could move on with my day. Self-made, you declare, as if you strolled confidently from your own badge, already fully dressed in a bowler hat and three-piece suit, banknotes in the baby grow, baby neck long enough to reach your own lactating tits. Self-made, self-made, you wail again, self-swaddled in self-assurance, spouting stories of success. How well you learnt to read and write by reading books you wrote yourself on paper forged from the felled stumps of your own self-serving bones. Self-made, self-made, you moan, as if no midwife and no mother, as if no nurses and no doctors, no teachers, no tutors, no factories, no farmers, no friends, fathers, contacts, as if no hand ever held your own till traffic slowed and green men glowed, as if you never once lay helpless in a nappy full of shite, desperately screaming for a change.
Amazing. I'm not gonna guess what party that politician was from, but I think we all can. It's glorious. Yeah. I love that one. I also love the Queen is not your grandma. That made me laugh a lot, but also be like, yeah, amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. fact for most people.
Yeah, for most people, yeah. Lobster is published by Fleet and available in all good bookshops. Is there an audio version and do you read it?
There is an audio version and it's read by me, yeah. I would love people to listen to it. I love listening to audio books. I think it's a really nice way to do it while you're, you know, walking around, cycling, whatever.
Is it weirder for you reading out the prose bits than it is sort of reading out the poetry?
Yeah, definitely. Mm. Because I don't do that ever. And I don't really, obviously, I edited for like 2 years, this book. So it was a bit weird reading the audiobook because I'd forgotten some bits because after it was the final version put in, it's like, do not show you this book again. So the fact three of them. So some of it, but I'm like, ooh. But yeah, it is weirder reading out the prose bits.
Thank you so much for chatting with me.
No, no, thanks for having me. It was lovely. Have a nice day.
I am doing an interview IRL, as they say, which never happens anymore. It's always on Zoom. And I'm very delighted to say it is with Anoushka Warden, playwright and author of the new book, I'm Fucking Amazing. Hello.
Hi. It's a silly title, but also a brilliant title.
I want to start off on that. Congratulations on the swears, because the last time we spoke was about your... Was it a play? Was it a one-woman show?
Yes.
My Mum's a Twat,
yes,
is
yes.
What it was called. And yeah, I'm glad that your book title has followed a similar theme.
Do you know what? I was introduced to an older man who had asked me what I write. And then my first play was My Mum's a Twat. My second play was My Dad's a Cunt. And now this book is I'm Fucking Amazing. And it is actually embarrassing. But I have a film that is called 21 Miles. And I'm like, no swearing. But obviously... I chose those titles for reasons, but it just does make me feel like a bit of a knob when I have to say them all in a row.
To start off with, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you the question that I always start with, which is, what is the book about? Can you tell us a little bit about it, please?
The book for me is about a conversation around the line that sort of started it was maybe fannies and long-term love don't work out. And it's about a character who... It wants to be in a really stable, loving, safe relationship, and then that side of stuff, the desire and stuff, is gone. But this character just tries everything to fix it without maybe asking the question, is the relationship wrong? So I was wanting to look into what happens in that situation.
So I wondered, because obviously My Mum's a Twat, My Dad's a Cunt are autobiographical in some respects.
Well, My Mum's a Twat was.
Yeah.
My Dad's a Cunt wasn't. It was.
Sorry, though, slur against your dad.
It was, weirdly, after going through My Mum's a Twat,
yeah,
which was autobiographical, the rehearsal process was so brilliant that the feminist me got really riled up to be like, sure, if there's a mum who's a twat, I'm pretty sure there's a dad who's been a... I don't know, it was like my feminist response to my own work.
How much of this is autobiographical?
I would say none. Whilst also being like, it's completely influenced by everything I've ever experienced and been, from my own relationships to my friends' relationships to documentaries. I genuinely think if I had to pull the thing apart and say what was close to truth, what, I don't think I could.
Yeah.
So I very much treated it like a piece of fiction. But I don't know, I think any writer would maybe find that question hard, because it isn't autobiographical. But I just finished this film about a woman who swims the channel, which I've never done. And she had 11 failed rounds of IVF, which I've never done.
Yeah.
And my friend read it and was like, this is so you. And I'm like, oh my God, is it? Lots and none of it.
I feel like the voice feels like you.
This is something I'm discovering in my writing, because I would say I'm at the early stages across all the mediums that I write.
Mm.
And people keep saying about my voice, and this isn't something I've tried to create, but I didn't start writing till I was in my 30s, so yeah. Maybe, I don't know if that's part of it. But the voice, they say in my TV work or in the book, I'm just going to keep writing in that voice, but in my head I'm creating very different stories.
Yeah.
But if you read them all together, you'd be like, oh, there's that voice. But I haven't quite figured what that is yet, or the journey of that. But also, what's interesting is I've just finished book two, and I would say it is wildly different. But then, because the voice is similar, but really, I guess I probably need to find out how this one goes down before I... Because I think I know what I want book three to be, but there's no point if I keep just writing them if actually everyone's, we hate this voice, stop writing, go away.
I don't think that's going to happen. But yeah, you talked about the opening of the book. You open with a chapter called Wet Fanny, which sort of sets our protagonist's stall, really. She's no longer turned on by her serious long-term boyfriend, basically.
Yeah.
You don't shy away from quite taboo subjects in the things that you write. I wondered if there is part of you that kind of enjoys shocking people a little bit.
What's funny is, I think the genuine answer to that is no, because I really don't think what I'm writing is shocking. Mm. I think what I'm writing is just very real. If you and me and some other female people spent the evening together, I'm pretty sure we would just talk like this. So someone said my writing was brave, but it's not brave if it just feels normal to you. But I could appreciate how some people might find it shocking, because when I was trying to get an agent, lots of them were like, we think your writing's brilliant, but I got the impression that they were a bit like, we're more conservative in our choices.
Yeah.
So I'm very aware that this book might not be for some people, but I haven't tried to make it. What was great with this book, a lot of fucks, a lot of cunts, a lot of wet fannies, a lot of dirty stuff after the sort of halfway through. They didn't ask me to change anything like that. Mm. Also, I'm very bad at grammar. And because it's written in the first person narrative of, there's a one narrator, I got away with so much because it's, oh yeah, the narrator doesn't know how to put words together properly. But also, I learnt loads, more than I learnt at uni.
Yeah.
Definitely more than, I only studied English up until A-levels.
Yeah.
Going through the 2 years of the editing process, I learnt how to actually use a semicolon properly. I learnt that maybe people don't actually use the word whilst and it's while.
Yeah.
Oh my God, yeah. I literally have learnt.
It's not a word.
I know. I used it all the time.
I still do, even though I know it isn't a real word. Yeah.
So my amazing editor, Sarita Domingo, who is also an author in her own right, she's basically taught me English.
Yeah, comprehensive schools in the 90s. I didn't learn any of that shit.
Great.
As well as sex and relationships, female sexual pleasure is one of the big themes of the book. And I think it is really refreshing and charming to read a woman writing so candidly about it. Why is it? And I suppose the answer is sexism, because that's always the answer.
Yeah.
But why is it seen as such a statement when women write about sex? Is it a gendered thing? Is it a British thing? What's it about?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of the British thing, but I think you answered it before, because it's gendered.
Mm.
Like, what this character is actually going through in this instance happens not to be a physical problem with her vagina. However, it presents as it is. So she goes to the NHS, and I've had things in the past where I've gone and just not been treated like it's a real thing. Like, I had a very bad back thing, which turned out to be a proper disease, like a bone disease. And a lot of the male doctors thought I was exaggerating. Some of them said, if you have a child, often back pain goes away. And I was like, I have no plans to have a child.
Also, I can tell you that's not true.
So, of course, if that's happening in the medical world, us writing about it, it's just not happening enough or not being spoken about enough. And I do think that comes from other sectors. Like, I was reading something the other day where someone was writing, it was a doctor who in America, and she focuses on menopause. Mm. And she said when she was at medical school 15, 20 years ago, you have to select learning about the menopause as an add-on.
Yes.
And that the majority of the doctors don't. Well, and you're men. Like, what chance is there of this being a more normal conversation? But hopefully, I'm sure there's many other writers, not just me, these kind of books that have it takes us one step closer to, certainly for me, a younger generation of women having access to information.
Yeah, absolutely. You write very candidly about the NHS and navigating the health service as a woman with women's issues in inverted commas.
Yeah.
Was that always your intention? Was that always something you wanted to write about, or did that sum up
as you were writing? That's a good question. No, I don't think I set out to have that, because I don't plan when I write.
Mm.
I literally have been thinking on something for a few years and then I just sit down and splurge it, and characters come up who expect me, or like in this book, suddenly it turned quite sexy DIY porny. So again, with the NHS, that came up and then I got excited about it and wanted to carry it on.
Yeah.
And it definitely was through my experience of the sort of 5 years I went with my back stuff. So that definitely felt... And to be honest, like, every time I've had a smear test,
yeah,
I've got what they would call a hidden cervix, which just means it's harder to find. But yeah, guess what? It's not actually rare. Maybe one in five women. But every time I've had a smear test, they tell me it's weird or it's wrong or it's hard to find. And I'm like...
You're trained to find it.
Yeah. No, what's interesting is because smear tests happen at GP surgeries. Yes. And then the nurse, yeah, if the nurse can't do it, they get the doctor in. I remember for my last one, they'd like made me bleed quite a lot by, yeah, all the digging around. And so I just said, look, I'm not stopping this, but you guys can't find it. Now the area is like flooding with blood. Please, could I be referred to a proper gynecological, can't say it, can you say it?
Gynecologist.
Wonderful. And they wouldn't, they were like, come back in 2 weeks. And I wrote a letter and I was just like, yeah, I know if I go to the place with the right tools. So basically, you need your legs in stirrups and they get the really long, I don't know any
speculum.
Thoughts. Yes, wonderful. And then I finally got the referral and she did it in 1 minute with no pain.
Yeah.
That experience, like I feel like I've had, being a, yeah, female, lots of experiences where you're going and just not, it just not really being treated in the way I think if a man was going, yeah, with whatever the,
oh, yeah,
equivalent would be.
You can be sure that if someone's penis started bleeding, there'd be like...
I think that should be the quote of the day. Yeah, exactly. And bringing it back to what this book is about, where the character thinks her fanny's broken, and as it happens, it's not. But whilst she thinks it is, if that was the similar male character having erectile dysfunction, again, it would have been, I imagine, handled much differently by the health services.
There's that statistic that I can't repeat because I don't remember it, but like the amount of money that was spent on researching Viagra compared to...
I don't remember it either, but it was shocking.
It's a lot more than any money ever spent on researching women's stuff. But also the thing that I found really interesting about that particular bit is that the advice to her in this situation is just to go and stick slightly larger objects inside herself.
Yes.
That's like the solution to this.
Yeah, for the specific thing of if they think you have chronic pelvic muscle, like tightness.
Yeah.
So that the thing I used was about... like a physio. I purposely didn't want to write about a character where it might be, and another word I'm really rubbish at saying,
endometriosis.
I'm so glad you're here and you can just finish. I should learn how to say these words. Because I thought if I want to do a story with that, I think I'd rather it be real than the character not having it. But for that particular condition, you would get NHS physio, which is up.
I've had it.
Oh, what for?
After,
if you don't mind me asking.
I've had a baby.
Why did you have to have it?
Because her head was in the 99th percentile when she was born.
What does that mean?
It means that if there are 100 heads, hers is the 99th biggest.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it's not what you want.
And so what did the physio do? Help you get your control back of your muscles or something?
Yeah, so she basically got fingered by a physiotherapist.
Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah. That's exactly what's happened.
Little sort of rummage around.
But like a fingering, not for fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, ironically, is probably what a lot of our early fingerings were, when boys thought shoving the finger up was the goal rather than the clit.
Yeah, yeah.
Wonderful.
I hope there's some boys listening to this. Anyway, she's a very real and very relatable and very likeable character, I think.
When I wrote it, I really also wanted the two male characters in it to be really likeable. I think it's really easy to write stories that involve cheating and not ideal behaviour. I really wanted to write it in a really human way, which is... nice humans do bad things, and that was definitely at my core for her. Weirdly, one of the inspirations when I started writing it was, in my head, I was writing like Dexter, only Dexter is a woman who creates like a unique cheating, not cheating system. But in my head, I was like, that's what I'm writing. And obviously, if you read it, you wouldn't even necessarily think that. But the brilliant thing about Dexter was he killed people, but you were really rooting for him.
Yeah.
And that's the core of what I wanted to do with this.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, because I last interviewed you, I think maybe 5 years ago now, just before you were going to Edinburgh with My Mum's a Twat. You've been up to like loads and loads of different things in that time. Can you tell us a little bit about what you have been doing?
Yes, so...
Apart from writing this, obviously.
Since TWAT, I carried on working my full-time job up until about a year ago, which was head of press at a theatre. And then after TWAT, I wrote a TV version of it, and that was like a couple of years of like learning and development. And then I wrote a short film called Gobble, absolutely not a swear word, but an Australian person told me in Australia it means blowjobs.
Yeah.
But that is not the purpose of what it was called that. Uh-huh. It was about eating.
Yeah.
And then made it with a group of people so that I could actually be like, oh, you learn so much when your work's made in TV or film. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote my first feature film, which I'm working with the BFI on. And again, we're a couple of years into that and everyone's really hopeful it will get made, but at the same time, who knows?
Mm.
And then I wrote My Dad's a Cunt and it won a prize. And then that got me like a big American agent, which I think was way before my time. But because of COVID, maybe it like fast tracked me. But through them, I met the Bond Group, which is Amy Adams's production company.
Right.
And they were like, we want to read everything you've got. So I sent them the first draft of the book, which back then was absolutely just one long monologue. It was very much in my head, my third play, completely unedited by a professional. And they read it and loved it and were like, we want to option it, which is what happens when a TV or film company want to take your idea and develop it.
Yeah.
So weirdly, that came about before I'd found an agent to represent me and then send the book out. And then it all just went... And just everything then kicked off after I got my book deal. And yeah, I just finished writing episode one of it into a TV thing.
Mm.
And they're like, this is a really brilliant badass. We haven't seen this version of a character on screens. Hopefully all of that will just continue. I think that's answered the question.
It has, and it's also answered my next question, which was, what is next for you? All that remains for me to ask you is, where can we follow you to keep up to date with what you're doing and things around the book, events, etc.?
Great. I love Instagram. I think it's like a scrapbook, and that's what I use it for mainly. So I'm on Instagram as Made by Noosh.
Brilliant. Noosh, thank you so much for chatting to me. It's been a delight. And I will just say that I am absolutely loving the book. It's a very good read. It's very entertaining, but it's also like quite sort of poignant and lovely as well.
Oh, good. Thank you.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny off the blocks.
Welcome to Jenny Off the Blocks, that time of the week where we sprint past the patriarchy to the finish line as we discuss all things women's sport. That was a cycling reference for the uninitiated in honour of Dame Laura Kenny, who this week announced her retirement from track cycling. It still feels very weird calling a 31-year-old a dame, but I'll allow it. I'll allow it because she's Great Britain's most successful female Olympian. 5 golds and 1 silver, thanks very much, over 3 consecutive games. 7 world championship golds, as well as another 7 silver and a bronze, 14 European championship golds, and a spattering of silvers and bronzes. I mean, everything. She has won it all. So it is really sad to see her hang up her cleats rather than take on a 4th Olympic Games as she had been hoping to. However, she gave birth to her 2nd child in July last year, and she said that the sacrifices she was having to make in terms of time away from her family were increasingly difficult. And taking the kids around the world to major tournaments like the Tokyo Olympics in 2021 was, as she put it, absolute carnage. I mean, fair play to her. I basically won't take Lyra between London and Harwich if there is a rail replacement bus service on, so I can't even imagine. It was always going to be touch and go whether or not she qualified for the Olympics this year. British Cycling's performance director, Stephen Park, said earlier this month that her chances were only slim. So if it feels like the right time to her... fair enough, it's hard being a working mum. She says she doesn't know what's next, but hopes to be involved in the Paris Olympics in some capacity. Well, I think she'd make a great pundit. She's also spoken before about the challenges of marrying up, raising a family with a career in elite sports. So I wonder if she might do a bit more campaigning around that. I'd certainly love to hear more from her. Now, Laura Kenny, as you'll probably be aware, is married to former GB teammate Jason Kenny, himself a Knight of the Realm, and the holder of the most Olympic gold medals for a British athlete. And I'm going to use that to segue seamlessly into the next topic up for discussion this week, which is Emma Hayes and her controversial, in inverted commas, views on romantic relationships between teammates, which she labelled last week as inappropriate. There's been a lot of chat about this, some of which I think has been a bit silly, really. For those who aren't aware, Hayes was quizzed during a press conference last week about an alleged romantic relationship between Leicester City coach Willie Kirk and one of his players. Kirk, it has been reported, has been suspended pending an investigation into these allegations. The club said he was, and I quote, assisting the club with an internal process. Now, a number of managers came forward to say, in my opinion, quite rightly, that player-coach relationships are not okay. Player-coach relationships are not illegal in the sport unless the player is a minor, but they can breach codes of conduct, which WSL's licenses are contingent on compliance with. Clearly, it creates a power imbalance, which can be problematic, and arguably, it's also a problem for teammates who are competing for playing time in some cases. Hayes, however, went one further and added that in addition to player-coach relationships being inappropriate, player-player relationships are also. Player-player relationships are pretty common in women's football. Vivian Miedema, for example, is in a relationship with her Arsenal teammate Beth Mead. So anyway, you can appreciate the comments went down like a lead balloon in some quarters. Her own player, Jess Carter, who is in a relationship with teammate Anne-Katrin Berger, liked a tweet saying it was beyond bonkers to label such relationships as inappropriate. Now, I'm going to speak in defence of Hayes here, who has actually now backtracked and said that she'd let herself down with her comments. She added that she didn't think it was right to use the term inappropriate for such relationships, and I think I'd probably agree with that. Certainly, they are in no way comparable to player-coach relationships and the potential for abuse of power there. However, while there's no legal basis on which employees can block relationships between colleagues, as I understand it, certainly a lot would expect you to disclose that information. A lot of relationships happen at work, obviously, but I don't think it should be too controversial to recognise the old adage about shitting where one eats, and that clearly there is a lot of potential for conflict if things don't work out well. In an environment where performance can live or die on the ability to work cohesively as a team, it's really pretty obvious that this could be a problem. Anyway, I'll almost always back Hayes, as you know. I just want to mention that if you are in That London, the Set Piece Social Women's Sport Weekend takes place at Hatch in Homerton on Saturday and Sunday this week, and they would love to see you there. You can listen to me chat to co-founders Kate and Naomi in last week's Podzine if you want to know more about that. And that's all from me this week. I'll be back next time with more women's sport.
Welcome to Rated or Dated. Jen, what film that may or may not have starred Jack Nicholson did we watch this week?
You've stolen one of my first jokes, Hannah. This week we watched 1983's Terms of Endearment, which was released here in the UK on March the 16th, 1984. What a cast. It starred Shirley MacLaine, Deborah Winger, Jack Nicholson, just the once, like... and John Lithgow, with bonus Danny DeVito, who was apparently destined to make it into this week's Rated or Dated.
Oh, yeah, because it was this or...
Twins. It was this or Twins. So, you know. Anyway, the film was directed by James L. Brooks, co-creator of The Simpsons, as well as producer of Jerry Maguire and Big, to name but two. He also wrote the screenplay, which was based on a novel of the same name by Larry McMurtry. Hannah, what did McMurtry co-write the screenplay of?
Oh, loads of stuff, but I'm guessing you're referring to The Last Picture Show.
No, I'm referring to Brokeback Mountain.
Also, Loads and Dove, really great Larry McMurtry book, Loads and Dove, read it. But you might not like it, Jen, because it's a bit country and western.
Well, you know me. The film was a critical success, a box office success, and made Jack Nicholson, at the time, the only supporting actor to have won the whole Big Four Critics Awards in his category. That's the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, National Board of Review, New York Film Critics Circle, and the National Society of Film Critics. He was joined in 2017 by Willem Dafoe for The Florida Project, arguably a much worthier winner. The story follows widowed Aurora Greenway and her daughter Emma. The pair have a close slash weird relationship, leading Aurora to undermine her constantly, literally everything she does, in the hope that she'll hang around at home in Houston, keeping her company while she wards off the attentions of 1,000 would-be suitors. Emma marries a professor called Flap, weird, and moves to Iowa.
She's so American. Who has a baby and goes, oh, Flap,
I know what we'll call him.
Blah.
Anyway, they move to Iowa, and you can imagine how that goes down. She keeps having kids. Aurora doesn't love it. Emma and Flap run into money troubles and have a bunch of extramarital affairs. Meanwhile, Aurora has a neighbour, Garrett Breedlove. Breedlove by name, Breedlove by nature. Switzwoo. They fight a bit. Then she leaves the back door open for him, and they embark on some sexy times. Garrett, who's an astronaut, by the way, gets the willies, no pun intended, when Emma and her brood descend upon Aurora's gaff because of Flap's affair. He breaks it off, fearing obligation slash getting in his feelings. Aurora's a bit miffed, but then Emma gets cancer, which is a bit of a distraction, to be honest. Anyway, Garrett comes to visit Aurora in Nebraska while she's caring for a dying Emma. Emma dies and she leaves her kids to her mum, which is also kind of weird. It's a pretty, sentimental film, but the box office loved it, bringing in $165 million from a budget of $8 million. Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars out of 4 and said, "There isn't a thing I would change about it." And it was nominated for nine Oscars, bringing home 5 for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Supporting Actor and Best Actress for McClane. Fun fact, Winger and McClane, who apparently didn't get on during the making of the film, were up against each other for Best Actress, and Nicholson and Lithgow were up against each other for Best Supporting Actor. I had never seen this film before. Full disclosure, I think I got you confused with Beaches when we were talking about it last week. I've also not seen that, just so we're clear.
Lucky
Hannah,
you.
I know you'd seen it and hoped you'd never have to watch it again.
Yeah, it was the sort of film that my mum and my aunts watched. I can't recall watching it, but I certainly recall it being on, if that makes sense.
Living in a little house, you kind of end up watching what's on the telly, whether you want to or not.
Mick, I don't think you'd seen it before, had you?
I've never seen it before, Jen.
Hannah, did viewing this feel any different to you this time round, or can you just not really remember anything about it the first time round other than not loving it?
Well, I remember that everyone did love it when they watched it, but not me. But everyone else seemed to like it, and there was laughing and, you know, crying.
So I remember it being popular,
just in general, you know, people talking about it and it being a popular film. But no, it wasn't really for me. I don't think it, because I would have been, I don't know, 12, 13. No, I don't recall liking it at all. I did feel differently about it this time, in as much as I still didn't like it. But I came away from it thinking that Shirley MacLaine was fucking wonderful in it, even though I didn't like it. So I suppose I had a bit more respect for it than I did at whenever I saw it the first time as a teenager.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing about this film, hands down, is Shirley MacLaine, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like what they do with her character. I don't like how they constantly try and make her character look ridiculous when they make her dress in that stupid shit when she goes out to dinner with Jack Nicholson. She bought a scarf, but that's not enough. Her hair has to be ruined and all of that. But nonetheless, she's wonderful in it. In fact, that scene where, again, I don't like her, and where she's screaming at the nurses, literally full bore screaming at the nurses, "Give my daughter the drugs." I'm like, oh my God, that's literally the last way you should talk to a nurse. But nonetheless, she was fucking fantastic.
Yeah, she's great in it.
I wanted to ask you, because it is supposed to be like a drama comedy, did you find any of it funny? I quite enjoyed the sparring between her and Nicholson.
Yeah, I think I laughed sometimes. I think comedy's pushing it, but I definitely did some laughing. I think that kind of relationship, or the kind of relationships portrayed in it, luckily enough for me, that is not the relationship I have with my mum, although there is a sort of caring aspect as a child that kicks into play that I did sort of relate to. But yeah, they were quite fun to watch, them being fairly mean to each other. And I really like the tell at the end where Aurora says, "Oh, you know, let's not fight, we're always fighting," and Emma's like, "Are we?" That's very much on your side. And I really like that this kind of very anxious, uptight, hence all the ruffles, I think that's what that's meant to kind of indicate, woman has managed to give birth and raise a kind of very easygoing, just wants to get on with her life daughter. So yeah, it did make me laugh. I did like the sparring between Nicholson and McClane. They are brilliant on screen together, although he is horrific. And I'm kind of annoyed because I feel like this is a woman's film in that the main characters are two women, that he's the one that nabbed most of the awards. But they are great together on screen. I really enjoyed that.
I was really annoyed. And apparently he ad-libbed it himself, the bit where he gets his hand stuck down her bra.
Oh, that's awful. Like,
has that ever happened in the history of anything, that a man's got his hand stuck down a woman's bra? It was such a daft scene and it went on for so long. But apparently that was Nicholson just did that and they decided to keep it.
It was a different time or something.
In so many ways. People call their child Flap, for a start. He's a bit nothingy, isn't he? Daniel's in it. Is it nothingy?
Yeah.
Daniel's who I confused with Jeff Bridges for like the first half hour. Sorry, Hannah, I know that's... sacrilege. I just got their names. I was just like, Jeff, you know.
That is where the similarities end, Jen.
Mm. One of them is like a god in human form.
And the other one's Jeff Daniels.
Jeff, but just, you know. I wanted to ask about Nicholson's clean sweep at the Critics Awards because McLean won 3 out of 4, for context.
That's good to know.
I think Jack Nicholson's, he's good in this, he's funny, whatever, but like, he's amazing. It's just Jack Nicholson, isn't he? Like, he's just, he's much of a muchness, I felt. I enjoyed their performance together, but she's a lot better than him.
He is one of those actors who's very good at playing himself. You know, if you want Jack Nicholson, the person you need is Jack Nicholson, and he will absolutely Jack Nicholson it out of the park.
Or maybe Christian Slater if Jack Nicholson's not available.
Or you could say Leonardo DiCaprio for playing that, but I would suggest that you still need Jack Nicholson. If you want a younger
Jack Nicholson.
I don't think
Christian Slater's good. I just think that he's just spent his entire career doing an impersonation of Jack Nicholson, basically.
I thought for its time... In a lot of ways, it was kind of progressive. Like, obviously, it's set in Texas and Aurora's talking about maybe she should have an abortion rather than, like, keep popping out kids that she can't afford. It's about middle-aged people having sex, which I think we probably still don't discuss too much in film and TV. You know, the extramarital affairs are presented as just kind of like, this is just a thing that happens. It's not really, I don't think, massive judgment on either of them for doing what they do. There's no, like, this person's wrong, this person's right. And Aurora is very much her own woman living her own life. But then, you know, also she's portrayed as, like, not really being able to find happiness on her own, which is not great. And then, obviously, some of the things that Hannah was talking about before. What did you think?
I agree with pretty much everything you just said there, actually, Jen. Obviously, we consider, is it rated or dated? That's the question we're asking. And I was like, it's dated because it looks so 70s, right? It looks so sort of 70s, early 80s, because that's when it was made.
The ruffles.
The ruffles. The ruffles. And just the colours on the screen, even. The film technique and the hair and all of that is very, like, it's so distinctive, you know, the decade that most decaded. But a lot of the stuff they're talking about is still really relevant today. And I have no doubt that those kind of people still exist today and certainly still exist today in Texas. And if anything, with the new laws that have been brought in around abortion in America, it's harder to get an abortion now. It would be trickier for her to just pop over the state border to get an abortion now. So yeah, it's sort of more progressive than stuff is today, which is fucking terrifying, isn't it? And yeah, I think it falls apart when you look at how they treat Shirley MacLaine's character for having the audacity to be 52. 52? You've got to admit you're an old lady now, says her doctor. Fuck off, buddy. Go on, pop off. But yeah, I think it is kind of progressive in what it's depicting and talking about for the time.
I agree and I don't agree with what you've just said. In a way, Shirley MacLaine is surrounded by men. She hasn't just got off and married anyone just because she wants the company. It does present her as someone, okay, she's 52 and nearly dead in a lot of ways. But in other ways, what she gets from Jack Nicholson is not company, is not love. What she gets from him is basically good sex. That's the thing that she talks about constantly. That's the thing that sort of enlivened her. So rather than her feel some sort of older woman companion role to him, what she's getting is something that, you know, maybe she's never had in her life so far.
Yeah, hot sauce.
So
yeah.
I feel like that's quite progressive, that whole fan-fucking-tastic line that she does and delivers totally brilliantly. But on the other hand, I feel like it's quite dated in the sense that, you know, 20-year-old girls now that come from pretty good middle-class families, which is what Emma comes from, don't tend to marry their first boyfriend and then not have a career and throw their prospects away in that sense. So I feel like if that was made now, the idea that of what Emma was doing, if they were showing some young woman going straight from school to marriage and then loads of babies really young, we'd all be really horrified by that too, I think.
I agree with you. She is sort of treated as a quisling once she gets out of the country, though. Once she's out of Iowa, they are all a bit like, what, you don't work? That's all you've done? So yeah. It is sort of covered.
Yeah.
So her mum says to her, doesn't she, like, you've sort of thrown your life away, basically.
Yeah, but I think they go harder on that point now, and I think the audience would respond to that differently. You know, the audience in 1984 would have thought, well, you know, she's getting married. Lots of women still in 1984 were getting married to their teenage sweetheart at 20. My American cousins married way earlier than my British cousins did, way younger, and started families way younger. And I think that, like you say, in the country more probably still happens. But they are middle-class city people. I just think that would be a bigger plot point now.
But do you not then think that kind of proves the point that it was progressive for its time, and that, like, her mum challenges that at that point?
Yes, I agree. But what I'm saying, it's dated in the sense that now you'd just be like, for God's sake, I can't imagine many mothers now accepting it as easily as she does, even though she does challenge it. Nobody wants their daughter to be married with kids that young, do they? Do they?
Least of all to someone called Flap. Jesus Christ.
Least of all to, like, their first boyfriend.
I think it still exists, maybe not in the circles we move in, but I think it certainly still exists.
Okay, so Hannah, I think you've brought us very nicely onto the end point, rated or indeed dated.
I think it's dated because of the way it looks. I thought I was going to hate it and I didn't, so that was quite a nice surprise. But I didn't love it either. I was just like, okay, it's entertaining. The performances, I think, are great. And one of the things that I think is a really positive dated aspects of it is her prognosis as a woman with breast cancer. And mm-hmm. It was really joyful actually to notice that in the 40 years since this was made, it would be very different for so many more women today if they got that diagnosis, which I think is a really nice way it's dated.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Mickey, because also I think women now would be more aware. She accidentally finds out she's got breast cancer, and I think women now would be more aware. And even though the representation is she's so freaking busy, she doesn't have time to look after herself, I think the message is, look after yourself, is out there much, much clearer now.
Yeah.
So I agree with you on that. I would also say it is dated.
Yeah, also don't hit kids. I think that dates it quite heavily, yeah. Doesn't it?
And you know what? Going back to this, there were a couple of points that did really make me laugh. And one of them is when John Lithgow, when she hits the kid and she screams in his face, because he clearly can assess. That kid knows that there's something going on there, and he's trying to make his mum not have an affair, basically, by pulling her away as she's screaming into his face, do I say get into the car? And then John Lithgow says, oh, you're wonderful with the kids. That did really, really
make me
laugh.
What lovely children. You're so good with them.
Yeah.
I agree with you both. Yeah, it's dated. But also, I would say, side note, I didn't hate it as much as I thought I might do.
It's quite sweet, isn't it? It's really nothingy. Hannah had said to me, it takes a while to get to the weepy bit. And it really does take, like, that last half hour of a 2 and a bit hour long film is the kind of bit that I think it's remembered for. But I didn't mind all the scene setting. I'd cared about the characters by the end. Not loads, I'm never going to watch it again, but I think it does a good job of kind of giving you a slice of life as it was at the time.
I'll tell you what it made me think. Another Shirley MacLaine classic. When is the birthday, so to speak, of Steel Magnolias?
Oh, no. Let's look for the birthday of Two Mules for Sister Sarah, please, where she's a prostitute disguised as a nun. All women are covered. Come on.
Who's next, saving us from my potential pick of Steel Magnolias?
It's me. And I saw a tweet earlier that was encouraging people to say what was the most pretentious film that they've ever seen. And I think this might actually have made it onto some people's lists.
Oh, God.
2004's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which, spoiler alert, I fucking loved the first time I saw it, even though I don't like Kate Winslet or Jim Carrey.
Well, be an interesting rewatch.
Standard issue for all women.